Hey, good morning, everybody, and welcome back again. As usual, before we begin, we just have some quick messages. And also, please feel free to use the chat window if you have questions or things unclear. This week, we have this unfortunate situation that we have to run the labs fully digital because we had this small outbreak of COVID-19 at the student dorm nearby the university. And there were several students from the Department of Physics who actually were at that place. So the Zoom link, which we will keep for all the lab sessions, is something you find here. You should also have gotten an email via Canvas or Piazza about the setup for the labs this week. Next week, we have been promised that we will be back to a normal situation with the in-person labs, which are just essential for this course here. That was about the messages. Another message is about the deadline for project number three, so which we extended to Monday 26. And I hope that fits well for those of you who have midterms next week, so you get a little bit more time to wrap up the report. And you should gradually now have gotten feedback on both projects one and projects two. So you can use that feedback to gauge your writing for project number three. So hopefully the feedback you've gotten back on projects one and two is enough for you to see how we actually grade and evaluate the projects. If you have any questions, feel free to ask. I mean, don't hesitate to either write a question on Canvas or on Piazza, or just send us a direct email. We're more than happy to answer your questions. Now, today, in the beginning, we are going to abuse a little bit with slides because we are going to repeat some of the topics which we discussed yesterday with Gaussian quadrature and numerical integration. And as we said yesterday, this is going to function as a kind of stepping stone when we move to multidimensional integration. So if we have multidimensional integrals, the methods which we discussed yesterday, which are the appropriate ones for low dimensional integrals, which means typically up to dimensionality 6 to 8, these methods, they become numerically inefficient. And also the error starts increasing. And when we come to multidimensional integrals, which is something which many of you will actually encounter when you do actual research, then that's actually the playground for Monte Carlo methods. So we're going to use this numerical integration as a kind of stepping stone towards Monte Carlo integration. And then when we have set up the basic elements of Monte Carlo calculations, we will move on to other examples on how we can apply Monte Carlo calculations. I mean, from random walks, Markov chains, to the simulations of physical systems. Or if we want to, we can even use the same methods to simulate equations which are important for computational finance, like the Black-Scholes equation, which is a stochastic partial differential equation, and which gave Black and Scholes the Nobel Prize in economy. It's nothing but a standard diffusion equation, which many of you have met, with a stochastic term, and applied to financial modeling. And project number five, one of the options is actually going to include a stochastic partial differential equation related to financial problems. So that's just to give you a kind of a teaser of what may come. Now, what we're going to do in the beginning, so as I promised you, it's a little bit boring digestion of slides. And I wanted to use that to repeat what we did yesterday. So just to remind you, we are hovering around this numerical integration slides. And when we're done with that, this will take roughly half of this lecture, we are going to move into Monte Carlo methods. And I wanted first to give you a motivation and set up the basic definitions before we start looking at numerical integration, which is one of the I should say one of the more important fields of applications, because in one way or the other ones, many of the problems which we encounter in science can be rewritten as multidimensional integrals. If you're doing quantum physics, that's indeed the case. If you're doing statistical physics, that's also the case. If you're doing a transport of contrast liquids around the tumor, if you're modeling, that means you're modeling a problem in life science, then you're running Monte Carlo calculations with diffusion equations, and these are often also multidimensional problems. So Monte Carlo methods are, I should say, the most interesting part of this course. They're fun to use, and they also trigger your physics intuition or your intuition about a physical system, or not only a physical system, but it may also trigger your intuition about or develop your intuition about many different types of systems, because the threshold for getting started is not that high. And that allows you to be able to simulate systems without an overwhelming mathematical formalism before you start. So that's a lot of promise here. So let's see if I can convince you that Monte Carlo methods are pretty cool. Now, anyway, we need to do some homework, and that means to repeat a little bit what we did yesterday and bring that up to more serious calculations of multidimensional integrals, and you will see then where things actually can fail, or where we, with some smart transformations, can actually rewrite a multidimensional integral in terms of simple one-dimensional integrals, which can all be evaluated by the methods which we have discussed. So remember also that when it comes to numerical integration, Gaussian quadrature for low-dimensional integrals, they are what we would call the professional methods, the professional methods with a big P. And you would not use things like trapezoidal rule or Simpson's rule when you have typical integrals with dimensionality up to 6 to 8. So Gaussian quadrature are often much more versatile and give you much better results with fewer integration points. And the trick, as we said yesterday, is based on the fact that when you approximate a function, what you do now is that you approximate a function normally when you use a trapezoidal rule or Simpson's rule. When you integrate every small interval, every small piece under the curve of the function you want to integrate, you approximate that typically with a polynomial. So the trapezoidal rule is you approximating the function between two points, which then make up one of the sub areas you integrate over. That's approximated, the function is approximated with a first order polynomial, 2 points, first order polynomial, 3 points, second order polynomial, and so on. Now, Gaussian quadrature actually promises something more, that you can approximate the function f of x with two a polynomial degree 2n minus 1 instead of a polynomial degree n minus 1. And as we saw yesterday, if you look at the last equation here, this means that we can calculate exactly, when we made this approximation, we can calculate exactly this integral of a pn, a p of 2n minus 1 in terms of the integration points and the integration weights w. So the integration points x of I are the roots of a nth order orthogonal polynomial. And the weights, as we discussed yesterday, they can actually be found by an algorithm which involves the inversion of a matrix defined by these orthogonal polynomials. And typical orthogonal polynomials are Laguerre polynomial, Legendre polynomials, Chebyshev polynomials, Hermite polynomials, and many other ones. And most of these, all of these polynomials are actually solutions to differential equations. So if you look at the Legendre polynomials with ML here equal to zero, that gives you the standard Legendre polynomials. If you have ML different from zero, that leads to the spherical harmonics. And this is often used in the solution of problems where you have a particle moving in a central field. So the Legendre, this type of differential equation you see here, is something which pops up in many, many scientific applications. If you're looking at standing electromagnetic waves in a cavity, If you transform your equations from Cartesian coordinates to spherical coordinates, you can actually rewrite the equations, the differential equation, in terms of three separate differential equations if you're on three dimensions. And then it means that one of these differential equations will actually be given by the Legendre polynomial. So that's a famous set of polynomials which result as a solution of this differential equation. And we have these functions, they have orthogonality relations, and they also have recursion relations, which are used to generate the polynomials. So using that recursion relation and the orthogonality criterion, you can then generate higher order polynomials. The polynomials are normally normalized. So these orthogonal polynomials, they have some common features, and it's normally normalized so that the L0 is equal to 1. And then you can keep with L0 equal to 1, you can, with that recursion formula, you can actually start building up with L0 and L1, you can start building up the higher order polynomials. And the way you would do that, if you think of the first order polynomial, which you don't know, you have a coefficient a plus b times x, and then you use the orthogonality relation and then put in the limits, and you require that L1 at 1 is equal to 1, then you find easily that the L1 of x has to be equal to x. So this is the one of the ways you can proceed to compute the higher order polynomials. And what we have here are just examples of more higher order polynomials. So I'm going to skip some of these slides here because we don't need to look at all these details. These are just technical details. So the thing we did yesterday was then to look at the polynomial division. So we could then obtain the polynomial of degree 2n minus 1 to be equal to a polynomial of degree n minus 1, which was the remainder of a polynomial division. And we picked that one at the points where this x, the polynomial of a degree n, the orthogonal one, is actually zero. So these are the integration points. And then we had a set of equations which we could solve, because we know that this integral has to be equal to zero, because the ln times qn minus 1, these are orthogonal polynomials then, because we can expand this q of n in terms of orthogonal polynomials, again, the same polynomials. And this has to be equal to zero because this value of k never reaches the final value of n. So these were some of the technicalities we went through yesterday. And let me just repeat where we ended yesterday. So I'm going to skip some of the things here, except to remind you that when we did the polynomial division with a Legendre polynomial, in that case, an orthogonal polynomial, we ended up with a polynomial of degree n minus 1 multiplied with that polynomial plus the remainder. And yesterday we saw some examples of what the remainder could look like. And then when we went through the basic steps, we showed then also that the integral here is given by this remainder. And then in order to find the expression for this qn minus 1, we decided that if we take this expression here and computed that x of k, which are given by the zeros of this Legendre polynomial, so it means the zeros of this function here, then what we have is a p2n minus 1 as a function of this x of k is simply equal to this remainder qn minus 1. And then we use that one to find, so I'm going to rush a little bit quickly through here and just set up the final expression. So what we ended up with was an expression where we had to calculate the inverse of a matrix. And this matrix is now defined in terms of the different Legendre polynomials to up to a given order. And then we could define this unknown coefficients alpha. And with these unknown coefficients alpha, what we actually had was an equation of this type here. So this was a matrix which we had to invert. These points x zeros, which you see here, are the zeros of an nth order orthogonal polynomial. And then these alphas are the unknown coefficients. And when we have that, we could find the alpha simply by inverting that matrix and multiplying with this polynomial. And making a long, long story short, we ended up with an expression for the function, which we have the polynomial, which is used to approximate the function, which is equal to 2 times this inverse matrix elements times the function. And with that, what we ended up with is this equation here where we know the weights. This function here, p2n minus 1, is an approximation we make, but normally we replace that one with f. So that means that this integral is now approximated with wi times f of x of I. And that's the basic recipe. And we looked at some examples. I'm going to skip these. So I'm going to skip some slides here. I hope you can forgive me because that's something which we went through yesterday. But the thing which I wanted to discuss a little bit is the calculation of multidimensional integrals. But let me first mention some other types of functions. If you look at the case with where you want to change your integration domain, so you can use Legendre polynomials. So keep in mind that Legendre polynomials are defined between minus 1 and plus 1. That's their domain. However, when you have found the weights and the integration points, you can always make a mapping. And when you have integration weights and integration points between minus 1 and 1, you can always make a standard mapping to a new domain, which goes from A to B. And that means that you would have these weights, which you have, and the integration points, and simply make the mapping here. This is just a basic standard mapping from one domain to another domain. Now, clearly, this is a little bit more complicated when you have a domain which goes, let's say, from minus infinity to plus infinity, or from zero to infinity, which are typical domains you encounter in many scientific applications. So often you have an exponential function, and that has a domain which typically runs from zero to infinity. And you have an integral which then involves variables which are defined from zero up to infinity. And that's something which becomes a little bit more tricky if you want to use this kind of change here, because then you would actually have to approximate infinity with a number. You can do that, and you saw what happened in project 2. That was not fully satisfactory because you were approximating infinity with a given value, and your results were sensitive to the value which you opted for. So you have other possibilities. So one way of doing that is actually to use the Legendre polynomials. You can do that if you have zero to infinity. So you define the weights x here from an interval between minus 1 and 1. And then what you do now is you map them over. And you see now that when x is equal to 0, then, and oh, sorry, when x is equal to minus 1, which is the end point to the left in the for the Legendre polynomials, then you have tan 0, which becomes 0. So x of I tilde is 0. When you then plug in 1, you have tan of pi half, which is infinity. So this is a way to map your points between minus 1 and 1 to 0 and infinity. Now, the weights are actually given by the derivatives of the x's. So if I take the derivative of d of x, that should represent the integration weights. So if I do that, then I get an equation for the integration weights, which now correspond to a domain between 0 and infinity. And that's one possible mapping. So there are many ways you can do that. On the other hand, if you have a function which goes like e to the minus x, and you have 0 to infinity, e to the minus x times some other function which is going to be integrated, then you would rather use another type of orthogonal polynomial. And one of the orthogonal polynomials which you would use then would be something like a Laguerre polynomial, which has something like e to the minus x multiplied with some polynomial of x. So the solution of, and the Legendre polynomials are solutions. So if we look at that one, if we look at this specific integral here, if we have a weight function like this, this part here, the first part, x to the power of alpha and e to the minus x, as we discussed yesterday, that would be something which enters the definition of the Laguerre polynomials. So that means that I could now think of using another set of orthogonal polynomials. And the Laguerre polynomials are the solutions to this differential equation. And for those of you who may have studied quantum physics and systems like the hydrogen atom with an inverse squared force, which leads to the Coulomb potential, which is an inverse in R, the distance, that is a problem which often leads to a differential equation of this type here for the radial degrees of freedom when you transform to spherical coordinates. So the Legendre polynomials were the solutions of one differential equation. The Laguerre polynomials are the solutions of another differential equation, and they produce these orthogonal polynomials. So you could use Laguerre polynomials, and they take this form as you see here. So these are some of the first polynomials. So L0 is always normalized to one. We would then have a slightly different orthogonality relation, which has to be satisfied. And they also have a recursion relation, which allows you to construct the higher order ones. The zeros of these polynomials are well tabulated and well established. So many of the algorithms which generate integration points, they actually use tables of, they actually tabulate just the results. So you don't need to call, if you're calling an integration method many times, you don't need to calculate the zeros of a polynomial because you would normally tabulate them for different values of integration points. And another set of polynomials, which orthogonal polynomials, which are the solution of another type of differential equation, are the Hermite polynomials. And in project number two, when you added this harmonic oscillator thing, this potential, then you actually ended up with the analytical solution, which we didn't solve ourselves, but we just used it. That would be given by the differential equation, which you see here. So that would apply to the harmonic oscillator case. And the domain in that case is from minus infinity to plus infinity. So if you have an integral which contains something like e to the minus x squared, then, and the domain goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, then a bell should ring and that bell should just say Hermite polynomials. So the different type of integrals which you encounter, they can often be rewritten in terms of a weight function, which is this e to the minus x squared, which then belongs to a selected class of polynomials, of orthogonal polynomials. These orthogonal polynomials are a solution of differential equations. So if you can rewrite your integral in terms of some of these famous polynomials, you would actually use the integration points which are generated according to that polynomial. If you're not able to do that, no kind of factor which allows you to recognize it as an element of a orthogonal polynomial, you would simply replace that with one, and then you would use Legendre polynomials. So Legendre polynomials are normally the most versatile ones. But then you have to keep in mind that you need to make a mapping from minus one to one to your integration domain. And in the lecture notes here, you see what kind of integration domains you could actually use. So, and you have there's a list of the different polynomials here. Now, what I wanted to do now is to end with a discussion of an example of a multidimensional integral. And we are going to pick up this example when we now move on to Monte Carlo integration. And we are going to look at this example next week as one of the examples where Monte Carlo methods actually perform better and much, much faster than the standard methods we have been discussing now. So let's look at that example. We're just going a little bit towards the end of the slides here. So let me just do that. There are some other technicalities, but I wanted to give you an example here, which we are going to look at. So this is a multidimensional integral. And for those of you who may have done quantum physics, this is something which is used as an approximation to calculate the potential energy for a system like the helium atom. Now, the helium atom is a quantum mechanical system which cannot be solved analytically. You met one of the few cases in project number two where you could solve a quantum mechanical two-body problem with an interaction, and you could solve that analytically. Now, for the helium atom, you cannot. And there people have been guessing at different forms of the wave function, but we can just take this away and you can just think of this as a two-dimensional integral you want to solve. And if you think of Cartesian coordinates, so this would be dx1, dx2, dx3, particle one, or object one, if you prefer that. And r2 would be x, y, and z for the second object. And then there is an exponential function. And then there is an ugly Coulomb interaction term, which depends on the relative distance. Now, this integral can also be solved analytically. And it's actually not so difficult to do that, but it requires some small efforts with rewriting the integral in a smarter way. But you could now think of, okay, now this guy here has been preaching about Gaussian quadrature. Let's try to apply that without thinking. So let's take a brute force approach. So the brute force approach would now be to take Gauss-Legendre quadrature and then approximate minus infinity and plus infinity with a constant. So we could typically look at the value of e to the minus alpha r1 plus r2 and see where this dies out. And that could typically set up a kind of limit here. Suppose we run it from minus 5 to plus 5. So this is an approximation and it's not very intelligent. And it's gonna make us waste a lot of cycles. But the brute force approach you could take now is simply to use Gauss-Legendre and then produce integration points between minus 1 and plus 1 and then map them to another value from, let's say, minus 5 to plus 5. And then simply set up a given number of integration points and evaluate the integral. So there's a minus 2. Oh yeah, now this should be in the integral here, there should be e to the minus 2 alpha r1 plus r2. Because when you calculate it quantum mechanically, you actually square the function. So you have this function squared in the integral. So let me just write it down on the whiteboard here. So let me just, that's a good question actually. So let me just try to clarify that piece for you guys. So let's just bring that up. So what we've done here, so let me just take this one away and then we come back to Monte Carlo integration. So what we are setting up now is an integral where we have in three dimensions dr1, and then we have a dr2, and then we are having this wave function squared. It depends on r1 and r2. So this is actually squared. That's when we do a quantum mechanical expectation value. And then we have this other function, which depends only on the relative distance. So this is 1 divided by r1 minus r2 here. And then dr1 is simply dx1 times dy1 and dz1. And similarly with dr2 is dx2, dy2, and dz2. And this r1, when I look at just r1 or r of I, that is going to be equal to x of I squared plus y of I squared, this is an I, plus z of I squared. So that's the absolute value of R. And then R1 minus R2 here is simply now given by X1 minus X2 squared plus Y1 minus Y2 squared. And then it continues with a plus a set 1 minus a set 2 squared. So this was actually a project 3 last year where people were looking at the numerical integration using different methods from the standard Gaussian quadrature to Monte Carlo integration. Now, what we could do now is just to do a brute force approach. So we could now simply say that X1 and X2, they are defined in a domain from, let's say, a variable minus lambda to plus lambda, which is a finite number. In principle, what we should have had is actually a domain from minus infinity to plus infinity. But we are approximating that one with a fixed domain. And this lambda could be equal to 5 or 10 or some other values which we fixed, and then we have to play around with it. And then what we would do is to use Legendre polynomials, and we would perform a mapping from minus 1 and plus 1 to this new domain minus lambda to plus a lambda. So in that case, these x of i's, and we should write x of I for the Legendre polynomial is between minus 1 and 1. And then we have to perform a mapping. And we can do the same for y and z. So we would then repeat for y and z. So that means that the integral is now approximated, the integral we want to evaluate, this integral up here, that is now approximated with an integral over some minus lambda to plus lambda of dx1. And then we have a new one, minus lambda. And then we have a dx2. And this goes all the way up to z2. And then I have my function, which is e to the minus 2 times the parameter alpha times this r1 plus r2. So these are the absolute values of r1 and r2. And then we have this relative distance, r1 minus r2. So that would be life in a Cartesian world. And just implementing Gaussian quadrature, because I preached so much about it yesterday that you fell in love with it, like I have done. And then you would simply go back, call a function which sets up the integration points. You would then get the integration points and move on. And this is the code which you would have. So there is a function in the lecture notes, the programs for the lecture slide, the programs for the lecture notes, which is called Gauss-Legendre points. So you transfer your limit, A and B. This function actually sets up by default minus 1 plus 1, but then it performs a mapping for you. So if you decide that A is minus 10 and B is plus 10, it performs the mapping from minus 1 and 1 to minus 10 and plus 10. It returns X and W, and you specify the number of integration points. And now you see what you're doing now is extremely brute force. So you perform a 6-double loop. It doesn't look very intelligent, does it? So this is just you breaking down all the integrals. And then you have the weights for the X, Y, and Z. And then you have the function. There's a function you want to integrate, which depends on all these Cartesian coordinates. So this is without thinking. And you could actually solve this integral. What you will see is that the result will depend heavily on where you put infinity. And they will also depend heavily on the number of integration points. And thirdly, it's going to be extremely slow. And you're going to waste a lot of cycles on trial and error to find the optimal integration points and the optimal number of the limits A and B. So any questions so far? Is everything clear? So what you could do now is to think a little bit. Hopefully, you're still able to do that. I mean, you are able to do that. The function you want to integrate, which you see here, is just written in plain Cartesian coordinates, and it simply calculates this the exponentials and the denominator of the formula Coulomb interaction, and then you simply return these values. Now, what you could do now is to think a little bit and say, hey, somebody preached about spherical coordinates. So why don't they use spherical coordinates? So this is not very efficient the way we did it. So you can easily end up in situations where the integrand diverges. That's one thing. Actually, this is a finite result. The limits have to be approximated with a finite number. So what you would do then is simply, after some thinking, to change to spherical coordinates. And if you do that, now you see that you would have R1, which goes from 0 to infinity, instead of x1, y1, z1, x2, y2, and so on, which go from minus infinity to plus infinity. So R1 and R2 go from 0 to infinity. Theta 1 and theta 2 go from 0 to pi. So that means you could use Gauss-Legendre for that and just generate points between 0 and pi. And phi 1 and phi 2, they run from 0 to 2 pi. Now, what you have to do now is there's a small price tag to pay here. There's no free lunch, although this actually makes things much, much easier. And this is the way you would proceed if you want to solve this integral analytically. So this integral has an analytical solution, and you would actually go via spherical coordinates to obtain that. So you would get a cosine beta, which is now given in terms of the cosine theta 1, theta 2, and the sines, and so on. So this is just a technicality. Then your integral now looks differently. So you would have an integral now where you have different integration limits. So instead of having the minus infinities to plus infinities for all the variables, you see now that the phis and the thetas, they run over small domains and finite domains, which means that we can easily use Gauss-Legendre to generate the integration points and weights for theta 1, theta 2, phi 1, and phi 2. And then what we would have to do is to think a little bit deeper on how we would integrate R1 and R2. But what you see now with R1 and R2 is that there is an exponential. And then when you see an exponential and an integral which goes like e to the minus x and an integral which goes from 0 to infinity, then it simply should ring a bell which says Laguerre polynomials. So it means that you would use Laguerre polynomials for the integrations in R and Legendre polynomials for the integrations for the angles. But you still have to evaluate the integrand. I mean, that has to be done. So the new integrand now simplifies the numerical approach, because we have the finite intervals for the angles, and we can use Laguerre polynomials for the radial variables. So if we do that, what we end up for the angles, you perform an integration over theta 1, theta I, actually 0 to pi, and 0 to 2 pi. And the Gauss-Laguerre takes properly care of the integrands involving this R of I squared, because you will have an R of I squared there and an R of I squared here. So the Gauss-Laguerre would take care of that specific form. And the only thing you're left with then is actually the 1 over R12, which you need to think a little bit deeper about. But the if you now look at the results, if you do a calculation with Gauss-Laguerre, so this is something which I run with 20 integration points, you see now that the error is still pretty large. And with 20 integration points, you're actually doing this for six integrals. So this is 20 to to the power of 6. And it takes typically 3-4 minutes on my laptop. And depending on RMAX, you see that the results are not impressive. So this is something you would not brag about to your friends. So Gauss-Legendre in a brute force way is not very good. If I now look at the Gauss-Legendre for one of these values, so RMAX is my weight approximate infinity, so I just put that one to 2. So I integrate from -2 to +2. And you see now that when I go up to third integration points, it's sneaking slowly down, the error is sneaking slowly down. It's getting smaller and smaller, but still it's not impressive. And when I use my Gauss-Laguerre with the third integration points, I'm actually having an error which has an order of magnitude smaller than the best approximation I got with Gauss-Legendre. And even with the 20 points, I'm actually much better off with the Gauss-Laguerre. You can see the full program here. We will be discussing that program next week when we have started with Monte Carlo integration. So you see now that if you can rewrite the integral in a smart way, you can actually get away with better results. But it's not always the case that you can actually rewrite the integral in a smarter way. And when you move to larger systems, if you now are going to look at, you're still in love with quantum mechanics and you want to do the neon atom, and you're only looking at the electronic degrees of freedom, you would then have 10 electrons in 3 dimensions. So that would become a 30-dimensional integral. Now you can start making calculations a little bit here. So let's go back to the drawing board here. And this will serve as a kind of motivation for looking at Monte Carlo methods before we take a break. So we could do easily this system with a helium atom. But let's suppose now that we want to be a little bit more ambitious and we say that, hey, I'm able to rewrite things in terms of spherical coordinates. And I would like to use spherical coordinates for the neon atom. So if we now take the same integral for the neon atom, so let's just look at that as an example, neon. So I would have 10 electrons. So each electron is in 3 dimensions, in 3 dim. So that means that we end up with a 30-dimensional integral. Okay, so if we do that, suppose now that I want to do this Gauss-Laguerre or Gauss-Legendre or Gaussian quadrature. And I've been now preaching that this is a very nice method. And you think now that, okay, I am having now a dx1 over dx up to 10. There is an integral over dy1 up to dy10. And there's a new one with d set 1 up to d of set 10. And then we have an integrand here, which depends on x1 up to z10. Suppose you take 10 integration points. This is, as you saw in that example, that was a pretty bad choice. It had a big error. It had an error of the size of 0.01. which is not impressive if you want higher precision with 10 integration points for the helium atom. But suppose you're doing 10 integration points. So your integration is a 30-dimensional one. So that means that you would need, and if we are now dealing with this in an extremely democratic way, so this would be something 10 to the 30 floating point operations, flops, okay? Approximately. So you have 10 integration points and you have a 30-dimensional integral. So you're doing this 30 times, or 10 to the power of 30, obviously. Now, if you now have, if you suppose your laptop is like mine, it roughly does something like 1 gigaflop to 10 gigaflop operations per second. So if you suppose now you can do 10 to the 10 flops, floating point. So now this should be so this is a small s. So this is floating point operations. So it's a small s, but flops with a big s is floating point operations per second. So if I wanted to evaluate this integral, and you saw probably from a Helium calculation that it gave a pretty bad result. I mean, it was not impressive with 10 integration points. This will actually lead to something like, if I just do these crude calculations, I would need 10 to the 20 seconds. So before we take a break, maybe some of you remember the age of the universe. So what do we expect the age of the universe is in number of seconds? Does anybody know that? Any good feelings for that number? I remember that when I asked for them, yeah. So how many seconds is that? Anyone who can transfer that to seconds? So it's 13.5 billion years. I mean, this guy here, I mean, you're really on fire. I mean, last time when I asked for the masses of all the planets, they just came out immediately. So this is the lifetime of the year, of the universe, the expected one. If I translate that into seconds, yeah, 10 to the 15th, any better? Yeah, 10 to the, yeah. I think it's closer to 10 to the 17th, isn't it? Anyway, what you have here is actually larger than lifetime of the universe. So if you want to use these methods, yeah, here we got it, 10 to the 17th, fantastic. So it's three orders of magnitude, even with this crappy number of integration points. So there's no way you can evaluate this integral, which is a petit quantum mechanical system. Neon is a baby case. I mean, come back when you are dealing with hundreds of particles, that's the cases of interest. So neon is really a baby case. And to evaluate that integral with one of these methods here, no way you can do that. And this will serve as a kind of motivation for why we are going to look at Monte Carlo methods. And Monte Carlo integration is one of the important applications of Monte Carlo methods. And it's the one which now is going to allow us to make this transition from standard integration methods, which work fine for low dimensional integrals, to complex multidimensional problems. And these are the problems which we encounter. And that's why Monte Carlo methods, the whole plethora of methods, are so interesting and so widely used. So this is just one case. And you see that just doing a brute force way, I mean, you would just have to wait for the end of the universe before your calculation is done, or even more. Any questions here before we take a small break? Hey everybody, welcome back again. So the as promised before the break, now we're going to venture into Monte Carlo methods. And this is going to keep us busy for some time. I just wanted to give you a kind of general overview of what is going to come before we can dive properly into numerical integration with Monte Carlo methods. There are some basic topics which we need to discuss, and there are some kind of weaknesses with our education, in the sense that many of you have not had a course in statistics. So it means that we will have to scatter throughout some statistical concepts. And the amount of statistics is not that much, but there is some statistics which we need to look at. And in the beginning now, we are going to look at some of these definitions. And I'm still going to use slides, but then we're going to go back to the whiteboard. So if we now look at the Monte Carlo methods, what is going to come now? If we look at what the plans are. So there is a kind of plan here. where we're going to start with an introduction and a kind of overview of what this is about. We are going to look at Monte Carlo integration as our first step of the implementations of these methods. We need to discuss some ingredients which some of you may not have seen properly defined before, but you probably have heard about these things and you have used them and they've been presented in different courses, but you haven't, since you haven't taken a course in statistics, I guess the kind of systematic treatment of these concepts is something which is lacking. So some of you may have taken a course in statistics, so some of these definitions are pretty obvious then. So there is a quantity which is going to play an important role, and that's called a probability distribution function. That's a very important thing. When we generate events, these are going to be generated by different random number generators. So that's an essential part of Monte Carlo calculations. We are going to look at examples from Markov chains and introduce the Metropolis algorithm. We're going to discuss example in statistical physics. And if we get time, we can do some quantum Monte Carlo as well. That's also possible. As we mentioned, one of the projects in Project 5 is going to deal with applications of stochastic partial differential equations to finance, or computational finance, as we call it. You will see that all these methods here, they actually appear in essentially all disciplines. So I had a good friend who left physics, and he actually got a job in an international bank, and he's running Monte Carlo simulations. And in his PhD, he actually did Monte Carlo simulations. So that was an easy change for him. The only thing he had to learn was about different financial concepts. And there are quite many people with this kind of training in numerical science, computational science, which can use their skills and competences and knowledge in widely different fields from where they actually started and did their masters or PhDs. Again, feel free to ask questions. So there is one thing which I like to advocate, and that's that Monte Carlo methods, they actually do enhance what I call algorithmic thinking. And the we are coming back to this because you can often, but I just wanted to anticipate this in a, how to say, in kind of overarching way. The threshold for getting started and to simulate a physical system is actually not that difficult. So what you need is a random number generator. If you have a probability distribution, you would use that. You need a rule for accepting a proposed random number. When you're integrating normally, you would accept all the possible points you propose. So that would be the sampling rule. If you're jumping left and right, you could have a rule which says that there is a bias towards the left. And you could say that there's a probability of 80% jumping left and 20% jumping right. Or you could say 50-50, if you prefer that. The and then you could have a rule which says that if your random number is less than 0.5, sampled from what's called a uniform distribution, then you would jump left. And if it's larger than 0.5 and less than or equal than 1, so you produce numbers between 0 and 1, and if it's less or equal to 0.5, you jump left. And if it's larger than 0.5 and less than equal than 1, you jump right. That would be an example of a very simple sampling rule. And then you can bring in some bias. And then you can start simulating the motion of a random walker. Then we need to look at some concept from statistics. So we need to define expected values. We need to look at the variance and standard deviation. So these are statistical moments which play a very important role. And then Monte Carlo calculations often lead to what we could call engineering techniques for improving errors. You will see now that when we move into numerical integration, there is something which is going to be called importance sampling. And that's a way by which we can actually reduce the error in the calculation. So there's a lot of efforts have been spent on improving the errors in the calculations. So that's a big topic. And that often leads to even many ad hoc kind of approaches. In this course, you will not meet so many of these methods, except for important sampling. But if you take more advanced courses in computational physics too, you will meet important methods like the bootstrap, blocking methods, jackknife, they have fancy names, as you can hear. These are important resampling techniques which allow you to estimate the errors. That said that brings us into a very important limitation of what we are doing. And the limitation is that when we run these calculations, ideally, we would like to have an infinity of samples. Obviously, we cannot do that. So that means that we will have a limited number of samples, which means that the quantities we will calculate, they will be approximations to the true expected values. So if you have a probability distribution, there will be true expected values, there will be true variances, there will be true standard deviations, but normally you will be limited because you will have a selected amount of data. And that will give you what's called the sample expected value, and that may not be equal to the exact expected value. And that's why techniques for improving errors, for making better samples and all that stuff become very, very important when we're dealing with Monte Carlo methods. So let me bring up some definitions. I'm abusing a little bit today with slides. I hope you can forgive me. So this is not a tossing of a dice, but it's a tossing of die. So there's a typo here. I should have corrected that one. This is wrong. So it's two. So if you have two, then when you throw it, you know that you can get one and one, which means two. You can get two and one, which is three, and so forth. So these are what you see here, and now this list here are what we call a domain of events. So these are the possible outcomes. And these possible outcomes, they define a domain, a statistical domain. And when you throw these objects, you know that you won't get two the first time. You could get five, and the next time you do it, you get three, and unless you cheat when you're playing in Yahtzee. But if you've been playing with your grandparents, I mean, my grandmother always cheated when she played Yahtzee. I always lost, and that's why I hated the game of Yahtzee. I don't know if you've been playing Yahtzee. That's a popular game here. I always lost it against my grandmother. But the possible type of events which you have are these, and they have a probability. So this is an example of what we would call a discrete probability. So, and the probability is 1 divided by 36. When we have three, we have two possibilities. We have 2, 1, 1, 2. So we have 2 divided by 36, and so on. So these are examples of the probabilities and the domain of events, which we are going to treat as stochastic variables. So the numbers are the outcomes of the physical process of tossing either one or two. You can't tell beforehand whether the outcome is 3 or 5 or any other number in this domain, and that defines the randomness of the outcome, or what you might call an unexpectedness. So the only thing you can say is that the outcome 2 has a certain probability. So if you like to do this every evening, you do this thousands of times, then you will see that you get all these different sequences here. And that's an example of the randomness of this type of experiments which we're doing. So if we look at the stochastic variables, the random variables that are characterized by a domain, which contains all the possible value that the random value can take. And this domain has a corresponding probability distribution. So that these are some of the basic definitions which we just need to set up. And then what we would say now that there are two main concepts, as you've seen, there's the domain, which is the set of all accessible values the variable can assume. And then we have the probability distribution function. If you now do add some more concepts, in the continuous case, if you have a continuous probability, the probability distribution does not directly depict the actual probability. Instead, we define the probability for the stochastic variable to assume any value on an infinitesimal interval around x. And that's normally defined as p of x times d of x, if we are in one dimension. So that continuous function then gives us what's called the density of the probability, rather than the probability itself. So you will often see this defined as a probability density function. And the probability for finding a value in a stochastic variable in an interval a to b is then just given by this integral. So I know that some of you have taken course in statistics, so this is pretty obvious, but many of you have not. So I'm taking the liberty of bringing up some of these definitions, because some of these quantities are going to be important for us. And then there is a in particular one quantity which will be of interest when we are going to manipulate integrals. And that's called the cumulative distribution function, which is simply the integral over p of x over a value from the endpoint minus infinity up to a given value of x. And this cumulative distribution is a quantity which is pretty handy when we are performing transformation of variables. So we are going to come back to that one. So let me just bring up one more thing here. And then the probabilities are defined when they're normalized. They're positive, obviously. So this negative probability doesn't make any sense. And they are defined between 0 and 1. Also, the probabilities are normalized. So that means that when I sum over all the possible events which I have, or variables which you have, discrete variables. So if you have a discrete probability, this is simply given by the sum over all the possible outcomes I have, then the player probability, and that sums up to 1. So that's an important quantity. And then if I have a probability density function, then I have to integrate over my domain, and that should also be normalized to 1. Now, feel free to interrupt me if there are things which are unclear. These are just important definitions which we have. And then we have some very important distributions. So let's, before we move on to the whiteboard, let's look at some of these distributions. Now, the one of these distributions is called the uniform distribution. And the reason why this is important is that most random number generators, actually all random number generators I know about, they produce random numbers given by the uniform distribution. And then you can make a mapping from the uniform distribution to another distribution. So that could be the exponential distribution, it could be a student t distribution, it could be a Gaussian distribution, and so on. But the random number generators, they normally have an algorithm, which is actually deterministic. So a random number generator doesn't produce true random numbers. And what it does, actually, it produces numbers which satisfies many of the statistical properties we want random numbers to have, but they are still pseudo-random numbers in the sense that there is normally a deterministic algorithm which defines the numbers. And that deterministic algorithm is something which we will discuss a little bit later, but it's important to keep this in mind that the random numbers which we produce, they are not true random numbers. They are normally called pseudo-random numbers, and there are tests which we normally implement to see whether they fulfill some important criteria for being labeled as almost random numbers. Now, one of the reasons why we have the deterministic algorithm to generate these random numbers is that in calculations, we are going to produce billions of samples. And if we have to use a table of true random numbers, that would slow down our codes considerably. So a random number generator has to be fast and efficient. However, since they are generated by a deterministic algorithm, there will be some correlations between the random numbers. And that can actually spoil the statistics. We are going to come back to that. So there were actually random number generators back in the 60s and 70s in the last century, which after some set of random numbers started to generate the same random numbers again and again. So you could have something like a series of 10,000 different numbers, and then you started to produce the same numbers again 10,000 times. So if you were using 100,000 points, then it would be only 10,000 of these points, which would be usable because you would have 9 more sets, which would contain exactly the same numbers. And clearly then your statistics would be extremely biased. So the uniform distribution, and in particular when B is equal to 1 and A is equal to 0, this is the theta function, by the way, when B is 1 and A is equal to 0, that's the distribution which is used to generate random numbers. Then we have a famous other distribution, our Gaussian, which many of you have met many, many times. And when we put the mean value mu equal to 0, then we, and a standard deviation equal 1, we normally call this the normal distribution. And then we have also the exponential distribution, which many of you have met. So these are some of the famous distributions. If you go into the lecture notes, you will find more, like the Poisson distribution, the hypergeometric one, the binomial distribution, and so on. So these are all popular distributions, which if you now go into this C++ library, so let me remind you of that one. So if we just go into that, this is a website which I always recommend to take a look at. So if you search for random, so C++ has a random class. And if you look into that one, you will now see that there are all kinds of distributions you can think of. So you have a Bernoulli binomial, this exponential, there is a Gaussian, there's a normal distribution, and so on. But then you have generators. And the generators which you see here, they are generators which generate points according to the uniform distribution. And they are essentially all generators which produce pseudo-random numbers to some kind of good level of stochasticity. And then they can be used then to produce numbers for the other distributions. So C++ has this random class here where you need to call one of the generators, and then you need to perform a mapping to the distribution which you are interested in using. And we are coming back to these mappings. So there are some important mappings which you can easily derive, and we are going to see examples of these mappings. But when we are going to run codes, you can use the codes which we have in the library, libcpp. There we have 4 given random number generators. But normally I recommend highly that you use the random class in C++. That is extremely efficient, and it's highly vectorized, and it's it has many options, and the kind of random number generator which is normally recommended is the so-called Mersenne twister engine. So this number 19,037 with an underscore 64 is a double precision variant, and that produces 2^19,937 supposedly different random numbers. And remember now that when you call a random number generator, you would like these random number generators to define a huge series of numbers which are different, because you are going to normally in big calculations you will run a random number generator billions of times. So a kind of a basic thing in Monte Carlo calculation is the more points you have, the better it is. So the more, the happier, because you get better statistics, hopefully. So with that, with these some of these definitions here, what we are going to do now is to look at more some statistical quantities, which are important for us. So let's do that. And let's switch to the whiteboard. So what we have said now is that the Monte Carlo methods contains some important ingredients. So we need a PDF. So that can be discrete or continuous, depending on the system which we are looking at, and discrete or continuous. We need a random number generator, and I'm going to write that as an RNG. So that's a random number generator. When I've these two ingredients, what I need is then when I set up the recipe here, is something which we are going to call a sampling rule. And when we are done with that, when we have sampled, then we need to calculate the expectation values. So we need to calculate based on that, we collect data. So and then we calculate the expected values, expectation values. And when we have done that, one of the things which we need actually techniques for improving errors. So these are some of the basic ingredients in Monte Carlo calculations. So techniques for error improvement. So if we now look at what we are saying here now is that if we look at the essential thing which we can, so everything we are going to calculate are actually expected values. So let's go a little bit into one of these topics here. So let's look at the kind of expected values which we normally end up computing. So we have, if we have the probability distribution, we can then define these quantities. So a typical quantity we would calculate are some moments. And if we now take a continuous distribution, so we would write this as the expected value of a quantity like a quantity X, or it could be a function. So this quantity X to some power K. In physics, we often tend to write this in a kind of a way which I actually never liked. It's a little bit sloppy way. But in physics, we often tend to write an expected value like that. And this is now given if we have a continuous function. This would now be given by an integral over the domain where the probability distribution is defined. So it would be a P of X. And now we're looking at the one-dimensional quantity of D of X. That's the continuous case. Or if we have a discrete probability, or. So this will now be a sum of all the variables which are defined into the domain of events. And that would be a P of X of I multiplied with X of I to the power of K. So these are the typical moments which we end up calculating. And you could also think of a function. So if we have a function F, what we would have then would be the expected value of this function F of K. And now we assume that F is a function of X only. So that would be given by us an integral over A to B. And then I would have my P of X multiplied with F of X to the power of K, multiplied with D of X. Or if we now have a discrete probability, I have a sum over the domain of stochastic events, and I would have my probability X of I, and then I have an F of X of I to the power of K. So we have some quantities which you have met many, many times. So I hope you can forgive me for repeating some of these obvious things. So what I would have is a quantity like the mean value. So that's the mean. And the mean value of our probability now is actually the expected value of X or the function F. So when I write it here, I'm just thinking of the variable X, but you could actually add F here. So then you would, if you need to distinguish it from some other mean values, you would put a subscript like F here, if you want to do that expectation value. I'm just taking that one away here. And that's clearly the just the integral X of P of X, D of X, or, and then I have a sum of X of I of P of X of I. Then the next quantity of importance for us is the variance. And the variance, we call that sigma squared. And sigma squared is actually the difference between the expected value for the moment of X squared minus the mean value squared. So the variance is defined as the expected value. If you have a continuous result, you would also see it written like variance of X. If you're looking at X, this is X minus mu, the mean value of P of X, D of X. So that measures simply the deviation from the mean value for the points which you have. So the, clearly, the smaller the deviation, the smaller the variance. You have cases, if you're doing quantum mechanics, this is for the quantum mechanics aficionados. If you have the exact wave function, then the variance is exactly equal to zero. So you have a value which you can benchmark things against. So the variance is defined as the expected value of X minus mu squared. And when you write it out now, you will see that this is the same as the expected value. So this is pretty easy to see, of X squared minus mu squared. And this leads to a quantity when we take the square root of that one, that leads to the definition of the standard deviation. And the standard deviation then represents the deviation from the mean value. So the square root, so sigma is normally called the standard deviation. That means the square root of the variance. Standard deviation. If you have a discrete probability, then sigma squared will simply be equal to the sum of I elements in the domain here. And then you would have an X of I minus mu squared of P of X of I. So that's an important, these are important quantities, which we will encounter again and again in this course here. And I guess that many of you have seen these definitions. Now, our problem, however, is that often we don't know exactly what the probability distribution is. So it means that when we are calculating things, we are not going to calculate these exact values. So the quantities which you see here now, this mean, this will be the exact mean for that specific distribution, and this will be the exact variance. But what we have to deal with is normally the sample variance and the sample mean. So let me just define the quantity sample mean. So you make some measurements, and I'm going to label this one with a mu bar here to distinguish it from the true mean value. So suppose you run an experiment, and in an experiment, you may not know what the probability distribution is. So what you're saying then is that each event has an equal likelihood. If you don't know the distribution, then what you would say that is that each one of these, each event has the same likelihood. So if you do this n times, then this would be given by 1 divided by n. Now you can show, and this is something like Bernoulli's theorem of large numbers, that if you have enough samples, then you should approach actually the true distribution, and that means the true mean value. But you should keep this in mind, because the sample mean is defined as 1 over n, and then I have a sum from I equal 1. These are the samples I'm making, and that's simply x of I. So what we have assumed now is that your px of I is simply given by 1 divided by n. So every event has the same likelihood. So we take a total democratic approach. But what you can show is that, it's particular for independent and identical distributed variables, that this actually approaches a true distribution. But with a finite n, in general, what we have with finite n, then mu may not be equal to the true mean. So this is the true mean. So if there is a distribution which governs your data, then if we have that one, we can calculate the true mean. But in many cases, we don't know the true mean. So when we run Monte Carlo calculations, the more data points we can get, the happier we are, because then if we believe in the law of large numbers, we should creep or get closer and closer to the true mean values. So that means that there will also be a sample variance. And we're going to call that one a sigma with a bar on top of it. And that sigma bar is now given by 1 divided by n. And then I have a sum of I equal 1 up to n. And then I have my x of I minus, but now what I'm taking, subtracting it with, is actually the sample mean. So this is the sample variance and the sample mean. So it means that what we have is, in most cases, we never get the true one. So these are things which we have to live with. And that's something which also forms an important field in statistics, which are called resampling techniques, which we will not cover in this course. But that's something you will encounter if you take an advanced course in computational physics, or if you take an advanced course in statistics, where they actually discuss resampling techniques and how you can get the best possible estimate for your expected values with the given samples which you have. So this sounds a little bit boring, and you may ask, why do we insist on this? But this is something which forms the basis for the calculations which we are doing. And it means that everything we calculate now will be an approximation to the true values. In some cases, we know the distribution, and then we can hopefully calculate. But in most cases, even if we know the distribution, the integral are going to be multidimensional, which means that even if you have an analytical expression for the distribution, you won't be able to calculate integrals in a meaningful way. That means in a reliable and within a decent amount of time. And this is often the case when we are dealing with the Monte Carlo calculation, that even if you know the probability distribution, this may be a complicated multidimensional beast, which makes it almost impossible to perform an integration and get the exact mean value, unless you can simplify things. Okay, so any questions so far? I know that this is sounds perhaps a little bit boring, but these are important concepts which we need to keep in mind. There is also another quantity which we are coming back to, and that's the so-called covariance, but we are going to leave that one until a little bit later. But let's now go to our first encounter of Monte Carlo methods and applications of Monte Carlo methods. So our first MC calculation. So suppose I have an integral now, I, from 0 to 1, and then this integral is 4 divided by 1 plus x squared of d of x. This integral has a specific value. Does anyone remembers that value? You've probably seen that one. Does anyone can remember what that ends up with? Any good suggestions? Yeah, 10 something, but it has a specific value. Because now you're taking the integral from 0 to 1. So there's a famous number. Anyone who can think of a famous number? Pi, exactly. So this is actually equal to pi. So let's now, what we want to do now is to evaluate this integral using Monte Carlo methods. So one way you could think of now is to evaluate this integral in a stochastic way. So what you could do, if you look at this integral, if we now define the uniform distribution, so we are looking at an integral between 0 and 1. So we take the uniform probability distribution function. And that function is a very simple one. So we have an integral from 0, we have 0 to 1. It's 1 here. And this is simply 1 in this domain here, from 0 to 1. So that's my P of x. It means that I can actually, since it's equal to 1 in that domain, I can actually rewrite my integral here from 0 to 1 as 4 times 1 plus x squared of d of x. I'm rewriting this as just a general function f of x of d of x. And then I can plug in this probability, which is equal to 1, 0 to 1 f of x p of x of d of x. And this is the expected value of the function f of x. So that's the mean value, the true value of the mean over this function f. Now, what I would do now, since I could now approximate this one with a finite number of integration points, and I could think of doing to calculate the sample mean. So what I'm going to do now is to simply approximate this one with the sample mean. So I perform this an n times, and then I have a sum over I defined in this domain between 0 and 1. So I would use a random number generator now, given by the uniform distribution. And this is given by f of x of I. So this is the way I would now start calculating my integral. So if I want to set up an algorithm here, what I would need now is to define n. I would need to define my f of x of I. I would need to initialize my mean value, mu, and I also need to initialize sigma squared. And I initialize these to zero because I'm going to sum up. So what I would have then would be a loop. So I would have four, and I would define an I equal one up to n. And inside this loop, I would define x, which is now given by a random number, RNG, between zero and one. And this is now defined by the uniform distribution. So I write uniform here, just to indicate that this is my uniform distribution. I would then calculate a value. So this is my x of I. I would then calculate my f of I, which is equal to f of x of I. I also need to initialize the RNG, the random number generator, by a seed. So a random number generator is a generator which needs a starting point, and then it keeps generating new numbers based on that starting point. So with that starting point, you would produce a sequence of number. So if you repeat this experiment with the same starting point, you will produce the same numbers. So if you want to run Monte Carlo calculations and you keep using the same starting numbers, you're just going to produce identical distributions of numbers. So I would do that, and then I would start accumulating. So what I would say now is that mu is equal to the previous value plus f of I. I would also define my x squared. So I want to define my variance. So what I could do now is just write sigma, or sigma two here is equal to sigma two plus my f of I squared. And then I have my n four. And what I end up with is that my final mu is equal to the value I've summed up divided by n. My variance sigma two here as a variable is equal to this quantity which I have calculated, sigma two divided by n minus mu squared. And then I calculated the two statistical quantities I'm interested in. And then I go back and then I compare that one. And now I should put the bars on top here because this is not the exact variance and the exact mean value. So these are quantities with bars. So let's do that to indicate here that these are not going to be the exact variances and mean values. So you see now that if I go back a little bit, I'm just going to steal one little minute here. If I go back, there is something which we call a sampling rule. So what I'm doing now with a random number, so I have the random number generator, I have a probability distribution, I'm calculating the expectation value, and my technique for the error estimate is very crude. I just calculate the variance and then I take the square root. But my sampling rule, if I go back now to the algorithm I wrote, is pretty simple. So the sampling rule is here, is in between here and here. So, and what I'm doing now, I accept all new x of i's. So that's the sampling rule in this specific case. Sampling rule. So here I accept everything without any bias. I propose a number x of I, and then I accept it, and then I use it to calculate my f of I. And then I just keep repeating. So you see the threshold for getting started here is pretty easy. So the only thing you need, random number generator, probability distribution, which governs that one, a sampling rule, and then you simply accumulate. And then when you've performed this over all the samples, you have the final value. But what you're going to see now is that the result is not going to be very good. So you will get a result which is actually far away. It's actually close, but you would be there with the 2 to 3 digits after the decimal point agreement with the value of pi. And you can't compete in one dimension. You can't compete with even the trapezoidal rule. So if you do this something like a billion times, you may get something which gets close to the trapezoidal rule with 10 times. So in low dimensions, these methods are really overkills. So the strength of these methods comes when you move to higher dimensions. But that's the topic next week. And then we're going to look at the improved Monte Carlo integration. And then we will gradually bring in these different elements again and again and look at more and more complicated systems. But this stops our first introduction of Monte Carlo methods.